I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection and Name That Voice. That is, of course, Maria Callas singing her heart out in Giacomo Puccini's Tosca in 1953. Now, name this opera. That, if you can believe it, is Tosca 21st century style. In the newfangled production, our heroine bursts onto the stage in stilettos and skimpy costume, and she belts out her tragic love songs into her radio mic. The drama does end in traditional style. She leaps over the parapet to her death. But then a muscular angel sporting black jockey shorts and white wings appears to carry her back up. So, is Puccini rolling in his grave? Should opera buffs seethe in the stalls? This Tosca debuted in its cultural home, Milan. Its creator, Lucia Dalla, argues that the old gal was due for a facelift to put her in tune with the times. The critics say the classical masterpiece has been reduced to lowbrow musical, a deep dumbing down of high art. What do you think? Is this a long overdue reality check for opera, with its impenetrable librettos sung by fat, aging divas? Or is this one assault on high culture too far? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now from the studios of WDUQ in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by Mark Skorker. He's president and CEO of Opera America. Also in the same studio is Ian Campbell, general director of the San Diego Opera Company, where he's held that post for the past two decades. If you're wondering how they both happen to be in the same place at the same time, I should mention that they're there to attend the first National Performing Arts Convention. Its theme is taking arts to the next stage. So, Mark Skorker, I have to come clean about this. I was just drooling when I heard Maria Callas and grimaced when I heard Tosca, Desperate Love. Is this taking art to the next stage?
My goodness. I think Maria Callas regularly took art to the next stage. I could certainly verify that. It was wonderful to hear her voice. For me, the question of the new work of Tosca is whether it's Tosca at all. And, are we in fact creating a new art and just putting a label on it, or are we rewriting Puccini's Tosca? So I have different feelings about it depending on how we're defining it. As a new work, I'd be curious to see it. As a facsimile or representation of Tosca, I might be a little more skeptical.
Yeah, because the question is, what is opera? I mean, what are the defining features of opera? You know, does that become a musical or a rock opera or something else, and is it therefore no longer an opera?
Well, definitionally, I like to use the phrase singing theater. I think singing theater defines a broad spectrum of cultural product that illuminates the spoken word further with music, and where the emotion is brought to new heights through the operatic use of or the singing voice, whether it's operatic or popular. Now, within the spectrum of singing theater, there is opera, which tends to have a more complicated musical score and musical demands on the performers. There's musical theater. There's also all kinds of new music. I think of music videos that you might see on MTV as a kind of singing theater. They're all related in that they use the fundamental elements of words and music, visual effects, movement. All of this makes these various art forms cousins within this family I call singing theater. I like to affirm it all as part of a family tree.
Ian Campbell, what do you think? Part of a singing theater? Is there a line, as director of the San Diego Opera Company, a line over which you go so that it is no longer opera?
I think there can be a line that you go over, and that usually is when you get to amplification. That, to me, is the real difference, that classic opera, in the true sense, was unamplified. It was the natural voice. And the moment you go to amplification and microphones, it is a different art form. But I agree with Mark that if it's vocal music telling a story, it is opera. After all, the word opera, when opera was invented, it really applied to one art form. The others had not yet evolved. The American musical theatre, the classic Viennese operetta, none of those existed. But they exist today because opera was there in the first place. MTV exists because opera was there in the first place. So I think it is part of a continuum. It's probably a tree with many branches, and each of the branches has its own fruit at the end, and they're all worthy.
Do you therefore say that the line to cross, you cannot cross, though, is to mic up the voice? I mean, is that the really defining feature of opera,
that
the perfect voice that can fill a theatre?
Exactly. I think that that is the real skill of the opera singer, and that's what the composer was expecting. When Puccini was composing, he was not expecting his operas to be amplified. He was happy to have them recorded, which is yet another art form. But he never expected to hear them amplified in a theatre, and certainly Verdi didn't and Rossini didn't. But the moment you start amplifying them, you then change the nature of opera. You can use, in a sense, an inferior voice and make it sound better. And therefore you have taken a step away from the traditional opera. That doesn't mean it's wrong. It doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's different.
The thing is, it's very difficult, isn't it, to get to like opera. I mean, I think you do if you get dragged into a theatre and you sit up there and you hear that wonderful soaring voice. But you work in outreach programs. I mean, how difficult is it to get young people to actually want to go to an opera when it's got this image of just fat ladies singing?
Well, as the president of the association, let me just take issue with the notion that it is difficult to enjoy. I think a lot of people on their first attendance at an opera can be absolutely swept away by the size of the emotional canvas, by the sound of a chorus and an orchestra and soloists, by the splendor of the scenic design and the costume design. So I think the notion of its being difficult is not an accurate one. I'd also take issue with the old-fashioned idea that opera is a stand-and-sing art form, and most of the singers who are standing are enormous. Today, there is a real balance between the musical and dramatic and visual elements of opera, and many of our finest singers today are also wonderful actors and actresses who can be credibly portraying the roles that they are supposed to be singing, whether that's young lovers or old wise kings and rulers or whatever. So the dramatic truth of opera is no longer that stereotype of stand and sing, but it's a vital theatrical art form today.
Well, let's stir things up a little bit by introducing a critic. My next guest, Anthony Tomasini, is chief classical music critic of the New York Times. He joins us on the line from his office in New York. Anthony Tomasini, you'll have heard that the new version of Tosca. What do you think?
Well, I basically agree with what Mark said, that what they've done is something different. I mean, if you look at movies, there's a difference between, for example, the Kurosawa version of Macbeth, Throne of Blood, which doesn't purport to be Shakespeare's Macbeth at all. It's inspired by Macbeth. It's a kind of riff on Macbeth. And something like the recent movie version of Hamlet with Ethan Hawke, which was Shakespeare's play, cut down a lot, but it was Shakespeare, and which I loved, by the way. I thought it was very riveting. There's a whole tradition of modernistic stagings of Shakespeare, and there's that tradition is reflected in opera. There's all sorts of wonderful or outrageous or interesting or productions of standard operas. That's one thing. But what they're doing in Italy is something totally different. I mean, it's not, I would agree that whether you like it or not like it, it's not Tosca. It's a kind of riff on Tosca, but It's not Tuscan, it's not opera.
Would you draw the line at the same place that Ian and Mark did and say it's got to be the perfect voice? Because you say there's so much has been done to operas. You know, you've got modern-day Rigolettos brought into the 21st century. The ENO, which is traditional.
They can work wonderfully, such productions. But the line, I essentially agree. I mean, I am a passionate defender of the status quo for the unamplified singing voice. That said, it does get a little complicated because in the pre-amplification days of Broadway, when Itzio Pinza and Mary Martin sang the lead roles in South Pacific, they came from different traditions. She was from musical theater. He was a great Metropolitan Opera and international opera singer. But they essentially approached singing the same way. There was not that much difference. There was difference in the size of their voice, maybe the culture of the sound, but... So there has been this shift. I mean, back in those days, there was not that the amplification in and of itself wasn't sufficient to sort of mark the demarcation between opera and musical theater. But today, I do think that it's a crucial element of opera. And I was thinking about your remark about how difficult it is to introduce younger people to opera. In my experience, my anecdotal experience, whenever I brought real neophytes to the Met or to hear an opera, what floors them is the voices, the actual voice. I mean, one young man who's a brother of a friend of mine came with me, and he must have asked me 12 times. I brought him to Rigoletto at the Met, his first opera, and he must have asked me 12 times, you mean they don't have any microphones? They don't have any microphones? He couldn't believe it. Just the sheer, voluptuousness of the sound. When I was a kid, too, I remember being in the stratosphere of the Metropolitan Opera House with only the vaguest idea of what was going on in Verdi's Aida. But the sound of Leontine Price's pianissimo high notes just floating up to the rafters of that place and surrounding me, I will never forget. That's what hooked me. It was like years later I finally found out what's going on in Aida. So I do think that the natural singing voice and halls that support it, enable singers to work that art, are very, very precious and in danger.
Ian Campbell, is that what you find with the youngsters? Do you actually, just briefly, you take a young person into an opera house and they hear that voice, and they don't need beautiful people or flash sound effects or flash visual effects, just the voice is enough?
The voice is enough. In San Diego, as in most American opera companies, we have a very vigorous education program, and we bring 12,000 children each year into our final dress rehearsals. And for many, it's their first experience, but for an amazing number, it's their 10th opera, their 11th opera, because they have become habitués already. And what they're excited about is the unamplified voice. But I do want to, again, get away from this idea that there's nothing exciting on the stage. There is.
Well, hold that thought. We'll get back to it after the break. Connection listeners, what do you think? Where do you draw the line before classical opera is no longer opera? Are you listening to somebody who's crossed that line badly? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking opera this hour, the new face of opera, the new face of Tosca as hip rock chick. Is it still opera? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Let's bring Sam straight in from Cambridge, Mass. Sam, hi, what's your point?
Hi. First, let me say that my bias is not the visual opera, probably because most of what I know about opera is listening to it on CD, although I've heard oratorios and some opera. But there was a comment made about the big, wonderful voice, and one of your guests was talking about that now opera is also moving into a dramatic kind of presentation where the people aren't, as he said, weird and big. But there was I don't know if that's so easy to say, because there was recently a conflict, I think, in Covent Garden.
Covent Garden, Deborah Voigt, yeah.
A woman with a wonderful big voice was rejected because she claims, and I presume she might have some right, that she was just perceived as too big. And to me, that was a very sad statement. And my question is, can those two things really be resolved?
Well, let's put that to the guests. Yeah. First of all, Ian Campbell, you know, Deborah Voigt was the voice of Ariadne, wasn't she? And dumped because she was fat. She didn't fit into the nice little black cocktail dress.
That's what they said. And that, of course, contradicts what we've been saying. We've been saying that opera is about voice. And when you have the right voice, then you should design for the figure that that voice is within. That was an unfortunate situation where whoever was making the decisions was not making them at the right time all at once. And a good artistic director will do that. You will look at the people that you have, you will look at the designs that are appropriate, because you do need the right voice in the right role. That is what opera is about. If we go to amplification, you can have any slip of a girl sing that role, amplify her out the kazoo and get away with it, and they can wear the little black dress. But I think that was a mistake, the way it was handled. I think it was bad in the conception.
But Mark Skorka, isn't it part of opera's problem that it has people sniggering behind their hands because of these fat women? Not so much Deborah Voigt, perhaps, but when you've got Mimi in Bohème and Violetta in Traviata, who's supposed to be consumptive, and you've got a 200-pound monster playing her, I mean, it does. It wouldn't it get people laughing?
I certainly think that there have been times when operas have been produced with people who are older or heavier or different from the characters that they're supposed to be portraying. But it is certainly not the case today that the singer who's, if you look at the Metropolitan Opera this season, Renee Fleming, who sang a very successful Traviata, is a wonderful actress and looked marvelous on stage and appropriate. There is a stereotype of opera, and I think one of the reasons opera companies are so active with their education programs and their community programs is because there is this lingering negative stereotype about opera requiring an enormous suspension of disbelief. That no longer is the case. I do believe that one way that technology and electronics has helped us is that ever since the videos came on the market 25 years ago, since telecasts began about 25 years ago, people have become far more sensitive to the dramatic visual impact of opera. And we have learned from the experience of sharing our performances on videos and on television to see how it looks on the screen. And suddenly opera has been side by side with other dramatic entertainment, and I think we have really transformed the way we cast and the way we produce in order to create a viable, contemporary, visual and dramatic impact.
Does that mean Pavarotti really marked the end of an era? The fat man's gone and there's not going to be another.
I do think that there will always be singers who are thinner than one might expect or heavier than one might expect. But for the most part, singers now recognize that a strict physical regimen enables them to sing better. It enables them to move better. They realize that if they have a beautiful voice and can act and are believable on stage, that they will work even more at the great opera houses. So there are new standards. The recording industry that's already been referenced in Puccini and hearing his operas recorded, the recording industry tended in the 20th century to skew our attention to the auditory. What we could enjoy at home was the sound. When you went to the theater, you enjoyed the full package of opera, but at home with the recordings, you enjoyed the sound. So the premium became placed on the beautiful instrument, regardless of the size or the age of the individual. Today, I think the pendulum is swinging back to its more natural spot, which is a balance between the musical and dramatic values.
Anthony Tomasini, music critic with the New York Times, what do you say to that? You know, yeah, Deborah Voigt, she may have a great voice, but the girl's got to get real. She's in the theater. She should have gone on a diet.
I wrote a very feisty column about that after that, which I thought was an appalling decision. In that particular case, first of all, she had a contract. But second of all, she's the great Ariadne of our day. And in that particular role, it was absurd because she's not actually playing, you know, the mythical Ariadne. She's playing a prima donna who portrays Ariadne. And she brings a wonderful comic touch to it. But I agree with what your other guests have said, that there is a real new sensibility in opera, and especially among young singers who go to the gym, and they often look great. And there are some, you know, tremendous actors who are really very handsome and beautiful, you know, young singers. I mean, Nathan Gunn, the young American baritone, could do Calvin Klein underwear ads. I mean, and when he takes his shirt off in a production like, you know, Billy Budd, where the whole opera, everyone talks about how handsome Billy Budd is, it's overwhelming. And obviously that lends an incredible richness to opera, and that's all to be applauded, and it's wonderful. That's great. But I get a little uncomfortable defending that too much, because it is true. It's not a question of suspension of belief, but opera has never been and is still not about that kind of literal dramatic reality on stage. It's amazing how much magic, dramatic magic, comes through the voice. And you can have some, like Placido Domingo, the last time he sang Parsifal, and the character of Wagner's Parsifal is like this young fool who becomes wise and becomes the leader of a band of knights in medieval times. But Domingo walks out on stage. He doesn't even dye his hair. He isn't wearing a wig. He looks like a man of about 60, which is, you know, he's actually over 60. And in two phrases, you're just with him. You believe him. There's so much conviction, so much integrity through his stance, through his artistic integrity, through his amazing singing, you know, which has such dignity and presence and power, that you just go with it. And he becomes that character. And I would hate for newcomers to opera to not understand, you know, that to learn that that's part of the experience.
I suspect you've just seduced quite a few new fans to opera in that last couple of minutes. Anthony Tomasini, for the moment, thanks. Let's bring in John from Durham in North Carolina. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John, what would you like to say?
Well, I'd like to second my agreement against magnification of voices. It's just a terrible experience. Just the other day, I was took my son to see a Broadway show, for instance, Wonderful Town, and while the performances were wonderful, they were all obviously magnified, and it really the effect was like you're watching a CD, and you don't get the great balance of voices, some larger, some smaller, some more intense, some less intense. That really gives theater its value. The emotional experience is hearing the live voices in all its glory, and in many cases, sometimes its failures. I go way back to the times of Delmonico and Bierling, and I'm telling you, as Mr. Tomasini said, I am very glad that they were on stage, because I could only afford the real top seats, and they sounded like they were sitting and they were singing four rows in front of me, and I didn't miss a word. And I am vehemently against.
Was it just done badly, though, John? The amplification. I mean, couldn't the amplification be done well in an opera? If you want to fill a huge theater, wouldn't you rather that everyone in the theater heard them well than a few heard a marvelous voice in, say, the first 10 rows?
That's not the effect. The effect is that they all sound the same. Each voice has, when they're all amplified, each voice sounds. They all have parity, so you get no differences and no distinctions among the different voices on stage. When I saw Kiss Me, Kate some time ago on Broadway, I could hear the sibilant S of Strange Dear as clearly as I heard the song itself. Well, I don't, you know, that's just magnification, and it makes everything homogeneous.
Mark Skorker of Opera America, what do you say to that?
Well, I certainly think John makes a very, very good point, and one of the challenges, well, I think there are two challenges. One is that as the amplification technology becomes more and more sophisticated, it becomes more and more tempting for people to employ. And amplification can be done terribly, of course, but it also can be done very well. And there are an awful lot of municipal auditoriums that are still being used for opera around the country, and their acoustics are fairly dreadful and not very good for the opera voice. The theaters are too large. So The question comes up as the amplification technology improves, when is a little okay? And I think the fine debate becomes one of, do we open the door on it at all? Do we use only the very best technology with sound engineers who are sort of a new specialty? So that's one challenge, is the improving technology and then the temptation to use it because it's improving. The other challenge, I think, is opera composers have a history of being innovators, new instruments introduced into the orchestra pit, new ways of positioning the orchestra pit under the stage. I think in the next few years, within this century certainly, the next great Mozart is going to be composing for synthesizers, and that composer will want to put the voices through a mixer and will have a whole concept of sound design. That person will be an innovator. That person may be a musical genius of revolutionary character. And what happens when great operas are being produced that use technology in a way that's a 21st century way? So there are some issues that we're going to have to deal with in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, being elitist, rock opera, there would be no problem if it were amplified. Gilbert and Sullivan, there'd be no problem. And as Mark was saying there, operas of the future, the next generation of great opera writers, they're going to be using all the technology available. Why are there these sort of precious little jewels on the shelf, the Verdis, Puccinis, Handel, Wagner, Strauss, that lot?
Well, one does want to perform works the way the composer wanted them to be performed. I'm quite conservative in that way. It doesn't mean that you can't introduce new lighting techniques or staging techniques. We put it in English. We're performing Mozart in 4,000-seat theaters, which is not at all the way Mozart intended. So we've already made a number of compromises along the way, and our claim to be purists is a fairly weak claim these days. However, the sound is the sandbar on which we have really placed our defenses to try to preserve that fantastic, muscular, athletic feat that is beautiful opera singing. I do believe that, there is some false dichotomy here between high art and low art. I love opera because I like it best, not because I think it is somehow better than these other cousins in the realm of singing theater. There can be wonderful performances I attend of pieces on Broadway musicals, Les Mis, Phantom of the Opera, that in some theaters have used amplification very well. So I do think we need to recognize that this is a choice that we make to enjoy opera above all in our personal lives and to stand for the unamplified voice as our standard.
Anthony Tomasini of the New York Times, are there certain sacred cows? You don't touch Traviata, but you can have a go at, say, Ben Britten's Peter Grimes.
Oh, no, you don't touch Peter Grimes either. But I agree with what Mark's saying. It's very complicated. Obviously, there are new composers, there are new innovators who will use synthesizers, who will use amplification, and that's absolutely to be encouraged, and that may be, the future of a certain branch of opera. But on the other hand, I was just this past year at Covent Garden for the premiere of the Thomas Addis opera based on Shakespeare's Tempest, which is as modern and cutting-edge a piece as you could hear, but in every other way is a traditional opera written for traditional voices with no amplification and no electronic instruments. And so there's that tradition. Maybe we'll have two kinds of theaters in the future, a house for experimental opera and a house for traditional opera. But this tradition is really slipping away. We're crossing a line, and you cannot tell me that the techniques of singing, of teaching singing, and how singing is done that have been constant for almost 400 years will remain when the practical reason for them disappears.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Russell joins us from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Russell. You an opera fan?
Yes, ma'am. Started out being an opera fan when I was younger, and I was introduced to opera and ballet and other arts through the Making Music concerts, which was very enjoyable as a child. And now I'm 29. I still look back on that type of lifestyle that I enjoyed then. I still enjoy now. To say that technology should be totally wiped out of the arts, I would dare not tread on those grounds. But to go to the extent of amplifying and to synthesize and digitize everything. I do not agree with this.
So you're a traditionalist, yeah?
Yes, the traditional opera is one that drew me to the arts. The just power of the vibrato and the diaphragmic push of the operatic voice.
Well, did you do some singing? Is this it? Because, you know, young kids tend to really get seduced by the arts because they try it and they realize how hard it is, and then you appreciate it. Like ballet.
Well, myself, I do singing myself, and I was introduced because of chorus in elementary school and middle school and high school. I was in choir, and also in my church I sing in choir, which I enjoy very much. So I tend to have a little bias there on the stance that I enjoy music and singing. And I love ballet, I love orchestra, and also the opera, but traditional. I very much am a traditionalist.
Russell, thanks for that pointy, and what do you think about that? There you go, young guy says, you know, when you try it, you want to keep it traditional.
I think what he's really saying is that the traditional operas he's happy to see done traditionally. We have to be very careful about not allowing the art form to develop and new styles to come in and new ways of presenting opera to come in. There's nothing wrong with that, and I don't think anybody who has spoken right now is against there being a new development. The real question is, do we go back to the old operas and change them to make them look like the new ones? It's like going back to the Mona Lisa and saying, well, Picasso has come along, so let's move her left eye down to the bottom right-hand part of the
And give her a smirk.
That makes no sense. The Mona Lisa is great the way she is. Picasso's works are great the way they are. They live together. They're part of a continuum of visual art. The same in music. Everything changes and there are developments, but you don't then go back and change the rest. Baseball has four plates, and I think it will continue to have four plates for a long time.
Connection listeners, what do you think? Are there certain classical icons you just don't touch? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. A bit more of Tosca, the new version now. I'm Judy Swallow in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. We're talking the new face of opera this hour, or rather the new sound. You got a smidgen there before the break. So did you applaud the modernization of Tosca, or did you wince in pain? Todd joins us from Waltham, Mass. Todd, hi.
Hi there. Judy, first I want to say that I admire your work so much. I listen to you on the BBC. I just think you're tremendous.
You're tremendous as well, Todd. What do you like to say about opera?
Well, the thing is that I'm a musician myself, and my mother was an opera singer. She studied with the Boris Goldovsky Institute. So first of all, I just want to say that I have the greatest respect and admiration for opera as it exists. But I also was astounded this year, not by an opera that happened, but an event with the Boston Symphony. It was called Ten Done, and it was a multimedia presentation. And my point is that I think that the use of certain aspects of electronics and even the utilization of some synthesis between say sounds that are created digitally and of course the natural acoustic elements of the natural voice and the orchestra is a tremendously new kind of frontier, and I don't think that we should be afraid to use it. I mean, we're in the 21st century. It's the postmodern era. I think we should embrace these new uses of electronic media.
But it seems from what you're saying, Todd, that you're describing a new production using all sorts of new techniques. I mean, you wouldn't want your mother to have been amplified and carrying a radio mic, would you?
Well, you know, I think that you know, with all due respect to my mother and her memory and everything, she just probably would have gone with a production like that, considering the fact that she would have been able to reach a greater audience.
Ian Campbell, do you applaud that? Ian, I should introduce my guests again, in case you've just tuned in. Connection listeners, Ian Campbell's general director of the San Diego Opera Company. Ian, would you applaud that?
I'm not sure what you're asking me to applaud. The idea of a new work being developed, I certainly applaud. The idea of amplifying old operas, I don't. But what I find is fascinating is the obsession people have with opera. It shows the power of opera. We've had all of the so-called opera singers coming along, people like Russell Watson, Charlotte Church, who are not opera singers, they're singers of operatic arias. We've had a spate of pop singers in America recording Nessun Dorma. Everybody wants to be an opera singer because opera clearly is something exciting, challenging, and wonderful. But they are still not opera singers. I'm happy for them to sing that music. I'm happy for Mr. Bocelli to sing opera arias. But he is not an opera singer by the same standard of the Luciano Pavarottis and the Placido Domingos for a whole host of technical reasons. But he can be a very fine singer in his field, and we should be writing operas for Mr. Bocelli to do today with amplification, do modern music with the modern singer using the modern techniques.
But let's bring in Anthony Tomasini of the New York Times. Anthony, we've kicked this subject around a bit, but, you know, why do there have to be some that you cannot amplify? But if you're writing a new opera for the same sort of voices, lavish production, but they can be amplified, the old ones can't?
Well, it's a good question, but it's just, it goes to, I think, one of the difference, we've been struggling in a way with the difference between opera and other forms of musical theater, and I think one thing that most people would say is that music comes first in opera. Music drives the form. So it's the musical components of it and the vocal components, which are a critical part of that, that are the most essential to treat with respect and with integrity toward the composer's intention. That's why, I mean, a production of The Marriage of Figaro that's set in the Trump Tower is still a production of The Marriage of Figaro to me, because, you know, that was the Peter Sellers production. It was performed in Italian by excellent singers, and now, whether you like it or not, it still is, you know, is the work. I mean, because it was, musically, in every way, it was done in completely traditional ways. I think we give that up with at our with great risk. But I agree with what the caller just said, that, and what Ian just said, that new works, that's different. He was talking about the composer Tan Dunn, the caller, you know, who did this work for the Boston Symphony. Of course. More power to them. You know, take advantage of all the technology and write new things. But I'm sorry.
Let's get some views in here. 843-8255, 843-TALK, because Eric's joining us from Raleigh in North Carolina. Hi, Eric. What would you like to add to the debate?
Hello. Well, to me, it seems that there are two separate things you're talking about. And one is the treating of traditional works. And I have to say that I could not explain to any of my friends the difference between the production of Tosca you're talking about and Elton John's Aida, which has been rolling along on Broadway, you know, with no controversy for a while. And the second thing is the use of technology, and that train seems to have left the station a long time ago. I remember in the 80s hearing a recording of a spectacularly bad opera, but it was clearly called an opera and nobody debated it, called Valis, which was based on a Philip K. Dick story, which actually electronically altered the voices and, you know, and produced a bass of inhuman sonority. So this has been going on for quite a long time. So either this discussion is late or the term opera is much less well-defined than we think it is.
Perhaps we ought to actually use the term classical opera. But Ian Campbell, Elton John's Aida, it's already been done.
It has, and so has Miss Saigon.
Was it good?
From what I know, yes, it's a nice entertainment, but it has nothing to do with Verdi. You should accept it for what it is. And this Tosca has nothing to do with Puccini. It's basically the outline of the story being told in a different way. We must remember that Otello, when Verdi wrote it, there already was an Otello by Rossini, but he made his own approach to it. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But we shouldn't waste time comparing Verdi's Otello to Rossini any more than comparing Elton John's Aida to Verdi.
Mark,
it's totally irrelevant.
Mark Skorker of Opera America, are there some, just certain precious crowds. You know, we've talked about if there are certain sacred cows in the opera world or certain sacred composers. Are there certain sacred places like La Scala? You have some rock opera there, and maybe Covent Garden and the Met. You know, are these the holy temples?
No, I don't think there are any holy temples. One of the wonderful challenges for an artistic director or general director like Ian is balancing the season. And there isn't one monolithic opera audience. There are many opera audiences, people who like new and unusual works, people who enjoy the traditional works, people who like the traditional works performed traditionally, people who like the traditional works performed in a new way. So the joy of being an artistic director or general director is trying to offer multiple audiences in the community a broad opera experience. And I don't think there is any opera company that is healthy artistically that is not exploring all the historical repertoire done with early instruments sometimes, or new repertoire done with new instruments. It's a real fluid situation that demonstrates the vitality of opera today.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Jeannie is joining us from Boston. Jeannie, hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much.
And what
My comment is, hi, I'm a voice professor at Berklee College of Music. I'm also good friends with Myron Fink, who's an opera composer in San Diego. And I teach classical music and popular music, and my comment is the traditional techniques are to be respected and revered, but the music on the page is a map. It's not the journey. And I think very often people mistake what's written as something set in stone, such as the Mona Lisa is affixed to the paper, whereas music is alive and ever-changing.
Yeah, but where does that interpretation stop? I mean, you can have a classical piece of piano music, and you'll listen to five different pianists, and they'll all sound different, subtly
Precisely.
Different, but not as different as the two Toscas we've been hearing.
Excuse me?
Not as different as the two Toscas, you know, Tosca the rock opera as opposed to Puccini's
yes.
classical opera. I mean, are there certain lines that have to be drawn, Jeannie?
Well, my opinion is, like I said originally, the traditional music needs to be respected, and there's great beauty in that. And some of the singing in the clips I've heard, frankly, is just bad vocal technique. And so one needs amplification in order to overcome poor technique. That's not to say style can't evolve. We're really talking about apples and oranges. But my main point is that something that's old, that's done in a traditional style, is well worth being done in that way, such as a traditional ballet is done with a traditional choreography. But that's not to say that the individual dancer won't have an interpretation, or the choreographer or the director. You know, I don't know if I'm making my point.
You're making your point very well, Jeannie. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
For that, let's go to Lynn now in Cambridge, Mass. Lynn, your point.
Yes, so many different opinions have been expressed here, but to me, I saw my first opera in a provincial town in Finland. I just fell in love with it right away. And to me, you know, whatever you're talking about, you know, it's everything coming together.
It can't just be the voice. Does it have to be the lavish costumes and the big stage set?
It's the music, it's the voices, it's the drama, and it's the theme. And everything has to come together to, you know, that's what makes opera so great.
Thanks very much for that. Anthony Tomasini, musical critic of the New York Times. It is theater, ultimately. This is entertainment. It's theater.
It is theater. The caller who said that maybe our discussion is a little behind the curve here, I think that my answer to that would be that he may be right, that the term opera maybe is not what you would apply to a work like Todd Machover's Valis, which he was talking about, or this new Tan Dunn work. But that's a relatively little minor issue. Also, the caller who was talking about different, there should be a range of interpretations, even with the traditional works. Of course, everyone would agree with that. But again, you're talking about subtleties of interpretive differences here, not something as dramatic as completely rewriting Tosca, you know, and turning it into a pop work. that's a pretty basic violation of what the work has been. You know, about the singing voices too, I was thinking that Bocelli's name came up. In 1999, I covered for the Times his debut in Massenet's Werther. It was his stage debut in opera. And there was great press attention about it, and the big question was, can a blind man perform on stage in an opera? To me, that was a ridiculous question. Of course a blind man can perform an opera with a sensitive director if it's done. But the question was, could Bocelli sing opera? So the house was filled with all these Bocelli fans, and you never saw more crestfallen faces in one place in your life as he began to sing in this, because he was used to singing only in stadiums and concert halls with massive amounts of amplification. And all of a sudden, with none of that, there was this tiny, fragile voice. And then in the intermission, I remember I described his fans as standing around in little support groups trying to account for it all. So,
Mark Skorka, a final word from you. I mean, ultimately, it's a case of bums on seats, isn't it? So if the new Tosca lures a new generation into the theatre, maybe then they'll decide to listen to the traditional version.
Oh, it's so hard for you to open that line of thinking at the conclusion. Yes, I do believe that a number of the ways that opera is available on CD or in stadiums with some of the popular singers Ian mentioned, I think that's good. It will certainly awaken curiosity among a broad population about the sounds of opera and perhaps the desire to go see opera in the opera house where I think it takes place most effectively. I would just say as a final thought that if someone who wrote an opera in 1615 saw an opera production, the Metropolitan Opera today, they wouldn't recognize it as opera. I don't think we would recognize a traditional Baroque performance as opera if we saw it today.
Mark Skorka, with that thought, thank you very much indeed. Mark Skorka of Opera America. Thanks to Ian Campbell of the San Diego Opera and to Anthony Tomasini, chief classical music critic of the New York Times. Let's go out, give the final word to the fat guy.
Oh,